So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review me.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
So if I was you, I'd sit down and shut the fuck up.
Oh, boy.
Just being in this miserable piece of shit city makes me fucking sick. We got
sounds like a party I'd like to go to.
Being Ohio and the rest of the entire wrestling world are gonna find out why me and my brother Devon are the best goddamn tag team in the world.
Hello and welcome to Review Away. I am John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting. And Wei, nobody cares, but you and I are in a different location, a first time ever location for this podcast, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh yeah, I think so. Wow. Does it sound exotic? Does it sound more exotic, in your opinion?
It does.
We are not in the Review Away studios, and why is that?
Because we had to have our original studio evacuated because there's been an outbreak of snakes. Because snakes. I open the door and all I can hear is like this hiss of all these damn snakes. It's like Jake Roberts has taken over the studio away.
Mm-hmm. It's like snakes on a plane, but in a podcast booth.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very loud in there.
Wow.
So we had to move because no one wants to hear hissing snakes as we try and talk about the Dudleys.
Why are we trying? Why isn't somebody trying to get rid of these snakes?
It's been, once you come down with snakes, it's a lot like if you get a severe virus. It's very hard to eradicate at first. Sometimes when you need a fumigation of sorts, it's brought on by just the simplest of things. Like, everything seems fine, and you go to fix a little problem, and then by the end of it, you got snakes on a plane.
Okay. All right.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm great. Pretty good.
Wait, I'm very excited.
Why?
Not so much for this podcast. I am looking forward to chatting about this, but...
Yeah?
A good friend of mine just offered me tickets to a Jays game.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really good
seats. Who is that?
My good friend... Wei Ting.
Oh, I did.
You.
Oh, yeah, that was me. Yeah, we'll be going to the Jays game, and courtesy of our boss, not me.
Yes.
So, I'm really looking forward to that. We're going to see the Jays versus the Tampa Bay Devil Rays.
We are.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we can include the fact that, you know, over the last year away, there's been someone out there in competition for your time, and I'm glad to know that when it comes down to this Jays game, I won.
Kinda.
But we can move on.
Yeah.
How was your, are you going to Ring of Honor tonight? It's Wednesday.
I mean, I feel like I'm already there, but yes, I am. And I believe you will too.
I will as well.
Yeah.
We are both going to
check out
the television tapings.
Yeah. It'll be a good time.
A rare Ring of Honor appearance by Kenny Omega, who has not been able to do any of the U.S. shows, but this is in Canada, so he is safe.
Hey, why don't we take this chance to because I haven't been following the ROH TV, so what do I need to know? And what do our listeners need to know before going to the show, if any of you are going to this Toronto show?
I think everything was largely put in place at the pay-per-view on Sunday night, which there's a great show on our website that recaps that pay-per-view in depth,
right.
Global Wars. which ended with a big angle. We had Jay Lethal and Colt Cabana for the ROH title. And then throughout the night, the Young Bucks had been teasing a new Bullet Club member and the largest super kick party ever. So when they had their eight-man tag earlier in the night, there were no super kicks thrown. And then they showed up. The Bucks appeared after Taylor Hendricks was trying to save Jay Lethal, who's the ROH champion. And then the Bucks came down. They super kicked Todd Sinclair. They super kicked Taylor Hendricks. They got into the ring. They had a stare down with Lethal and Cabana. The lights went out. Adam Cole appears as the new member. And then with Tama Tonga and Tonga Loa joining them, the Bullet Club ran roughshod. And we got no finish. It was very reminiscent of the Nexus takeover when they shot that angle. Just catastrophe everywhere, laid out all these people. So that's the major angle at this point coming out of Global Wars. And it seems that Jay Lethal is shifting over to a babyface. You get the impression Colt Cabana will stick around as well. But the pay-per-view, it was very strange the way they built this up on television, because up until the week of the show, they didn't announce any of the matches other than Lethal and Cabana, at least on television. So this has not been a pay-per-view that was very heavy on story going into it. It was just, here are the New Japan guys, the Ring of Honor guys, you're going to get some great matches, and that was the draw for the pay-per-view along with Cabana's return. So I think that essentially sums up the key things for going into the television tapings, and I'm sure the Bullet Club will have a big presence on the tapings tonight.
Cool.
So you're all set.
Thanks.
Maybe, you know, just to get you further up to date, maybe we will do some interviews ahead of time so you can just watch.
Yeah.
And we'll give you a camera as a prop. And then you can just, this can essentially be, we'll put them under the guise of interviews.
All
what they really are just a catch-up for Wei Tang.
Yeah, all for me. Awesome.
Just heard another.
I think I actually heard a plane this time.
Where do we work? What a weird. We're on the tarmac.
Anyway,
anything else going on before we get into our big review? Do you enjoy approaching these documentaries more so than events way, or does it depend on the mood you're in?
I'll say definitely. I think more often than not, the documentaries are a bit shorter and a bit higher paced than a wrestling match. So I'll say, like, usually I think the documentaries I look forward to. I should also say,
everyone wants to know.
Yeah, people are really concerned about me, and after hearing the podcast last week, and I guess I want to thank people for their concern, but I'm not gonna kill myself or something.
Was there people concerned about that?
No.
What a petty reason to.
No, people. I think people just maybe get the sense that I'm getting a little burnt out, and maybe it's true. But I feel like though this is just like how I've always been. Like, I don't think I'm any different now than I was 6 years ago when we started doing these shows.
Listen, folks, this is the podcast grind that people will learn to understand. It's not so much you start doing something, come back at week number 305.
Yeah.
Okay? There's going to be peaks and valleys. Believe me.
Definitely.
I hit that sometimes. Yeah. I think I hide it maybe a bit better than others, but believe me, when every single week begins and you know you have to do X, Y, and Z, it's a lot.
I'll also say, you might be more of a morning person than I am, because whenever we do these shows on the Wednesday mornings, I'm pretty much like at my most tired usually.
Because you're up Tuesday nights watching Impact and now Ring of Honor, so you're up even later.
That's it. That's exactly it. So no, please, no need for concern. I do, however, appreciate everybody's suggestions, because for me, I think a big part of my interest level in what we're reviewing is just personal interest. I just don't want these reviews to feel like homework. I don't think anybody should. You know, this is like supposed to be fun. Watching wrestling is supposed to be fun. So as long as I feel a personal interest in the things that we're talking about, like I do for this particular review, and a number of the reviews that we've done, I think it'll be easy. Also, I'll also say I feel like if I know that a lot of people want to hear something reviewed, or if there's a lot of specific demand for a particular show, that'll make me interested as well.
Yes. You know? Yeah, I also want to say that for the request thread, that I would love to use as much as we often can, but there's a lot of events in there that simply, it's the accessibility as well. I mean, it's all well and good that you request a Chikara event, but that's very hard for people to track down, us included. I don't really want to make a habit of we're reviewing something and we have to go out and like buy this show. And
it's more so like
because if we're buying something, that means probably none of you are going out of your way to watch this.
Yeah,
we're going to be maybe you just enjoy us talking about it. But I like to at least give everyone a week that, hey, you can watch it. You have your own opinions and thoughts about the show. And then maybe you want to hear ours as well. Mm-hmm. And that's why sometimes, yeah, we do rely on more accessible forms like the network, because a lot more of our listeners have the network than are more willing to go out and buy a DVD. And I also don't want to necessarily encourage people to go out and just find a fucking stream of some show. I would prefer that you go and buy the show.
Yeah.
But that maybe is not realistic for simply a podcast purpose.
No, I mean, I feel like there's room for everything. And I think the occasional, independent wrestling review.
I love watching
I
those
really
shows.
Like.
I love when we watch a Progress or a PWG show.
Yeah.
But I also want to make it as accessible to as many people as possible and not simply, well, I don't follow PWG. I'm not going to go buy this, and I'm just going to skip the show.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So we're balancing relevancy with what everyone wants. So make your voices loud and clear, and we're trying to make everyone happy, folks.
Yes.
It's the goal. It's the thing I wake up every morning and say to myself.
Yep. And we'll also work on getting a proper studio that works.
I can't promise that.
Yeah.
It will be wherever we can find time. Mm-hmm. So, Wei, can we, before we start,
yeah,
can we talk about your trip that you're going on later this year?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's still sort of tentative, but I had a friend recently, last week, tell me about this great deal for flights to Osaka in Japan, and I've always wanted to go. I've been to Tokyo a number of times, but I've always heard great things about Osaka, which a lot of people that I've spoken to say is sort of like the rival city to Tokyo. I know people from Tokyo who, I mean, it's sort of got like maybe more of a New York, Boston. I don't know what's sort of the rival.
New York and Boston are
New York,
a rival.
Boston, whatever. Yeah, it's sort of got like that type of thing going on. But anyway, I've heard people say great things about Osaka, and I love Tokyo. Every time I've been, one of my favorite places in the world. So, if people
go catch a show at the Ideon Arena.
I've never done that. That's where.
In Osaka, man. Okay, one of the more lively crowds. That's a great city for Japan.
I'm only there for a brief amount of time, but this deal was like only like $560 for a round trip flight to Japan, so I couldn't really pass it up. So
this is where you and I differ, I feel. You were going to go and you were going to experience Japan.
Yeah.
If I went to Japan, I would be going on a wrestling trip.
That's experience.
That would be my purpose of going to Japan.
What's wrong with that? I think that would be awesome. Do you just go? You go to see whatever you want to see. I mean,
maybe I'll come with you.
I think the deal's passed now. Okay. I say tentative because once in a while they'll have these deals for really cheap flights from like Toronto to Japan, and I don't know if they're priced in error or because they just have like a sort of like these extra tickets that they need to get rid of. I don't know. But the one time I got sent over to Japan to cover K1 for the Fight Network, it was this price as well.
Wow.
It was something like $600. And so I'll see these deals once in a while, but they don't last very long. So I think it's too late, John.
Were you going by yourself or with family?
The friend that told me about it, I'm probably going to go with him. And then I'm going to see some family at the same time.
So this is later in the year?
Yeah.
All right. Well, keep us posted, Wei.
Okay. Sure.
So Wei is venturing off.
Yeah, so that means I'll probably be away.
Oh, boy. Will you come back, though?
Yeah, maybe on Wednesdays I'll come back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we're now going to get into our review. Straight out of Dudleyville. Outa, not out of the WWE's latest DVD, Blu-ray documentary project, and Wei as someone that...
What would they have called this if not for Straight Outta Compton's recent revival?
They would probably maybe like Pleasantville, they call it Dudleyville, and it would be a black and white motif.
Okay.
And everyone is just shot as if it was happening in a bygone era.
What was like a big movie from like 10 years ago?
From 10 years ago?
Yeah.
2006? I don't know what came out in 2006. Did Doom come out? Doom came out in 2005. That was a massive hit.
Doom? Like The Rock?
Yeah.
I've never seen that movie.
You didn't see it? No. I saw that movie. It was awful.
Was it an actual hit?
No, it was not a hit. It was an awful movie. Oh, it was a dud, which is what you would want for this play on words.
Nice.
Well, what did you think of the title, Wei? Because I have seen Straight Outta Compton might be... It's this generation's Tommy Hilfiger, where we've got some knockoff. The knockoff business that it has spawned is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Everything is straight out.
I don't know if it's quite... I don't know if it's Tommy Hilfiger. This generation's Tommy Hilfiger.
Well, I mean, when that came out and it was popular for a few years and you got the logo and it was just everyone had like knockoff stuff to play off of the logo.
Okay,
and I saw it all over the place.
Right, right, right.
This is during the FUBU era.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think meme marketing is sort of, you know, the thing that companies are looking for these days, and they certainly succeeded with the Straight Outta Compton campaign. Didn't they have like an app or something that allowed you to write whatever you wanted? And
oh yeah, that was part of the whole viral marketing push for the movie.
And somehow it worked. I mean, obviously the movie being really good and getting a lot of buzz certainly helped too. So
some wrestling shows, they've used Straight Outta Comp tickets when they're all sold out.
Funny.
Yeah, it's good. A real stretch to make any of them clever.
Straight Out of Dudleyville, I think it's fitting for the time, but it certainly will seem dated, I'd say.
I was going to form an opinion based on yours, because I thought you would have more
of a
reaction to it, and you seem fine with it, so the world can be okay.
I don't
with
hate
the title.
It. No, there's nothing to hate about it.
In terms of the documentaries that I've noticed, this runs at about an hour 15, which I don't know why they're so concerned about condensing it to such a time. I think that, or is this long enough?
I was satisfied.
Yeah.
I mean,
they did cover a lot.
I thought you covered everything that you needed to, including a large portion about TNA, which I did not.
I wouldn't say a large portion, but it was covered.
Well,
it was about 4 minutes.
Compared to some of the other documentaries they've done, like
Sting, for instance. I mean, they very much make TNA feel like this, like it's a fucking pit stop for your next destination and your prior one.
For sure. And, you know, it kind of seemed that way even in this one, but I'll say in this particular DVD, it was the most we had gotten about TNA of any of the documentaries they produced.
Yeah, we might actually get 5 minutes down the road if we have to do an AJ Styles. How do you do an AJ Styles DVD without a heavy concentration on TNA?
You have to. I mean... that's when I would even wait to see if... I feel like one day it's inevitable the WWE will acquire that video library. So you can't really do an AJ DVD until you have a lot of those matches, in my opinion.
Believe me, there are times I watch Impact and there will be certain scenes where it's like in your head, it's like, this is the B-roll for the DVD, the WWE.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's it. The Hardy Boys DVD, if they ever come back, yeah.
There are three Willows in the ring.
Yeah.
But this particular, it was very funny, though, that even in the explanation of TNA, which is somewhere where...
Which was actually mentioned by letters.
Yes, like, they did acknowledge
the
TNA.
Multiple
there was,
times.
There was no test in Albert graphic either.
Yep.
It was fully TNA. But Bubba flat out saying, we went to TNA, but it was also so that we could go to Japan.
Yeah.
It was almost like...
We had to do this in order to do what we really wanted.
It's like justifying this girl you dated that you knew was crazy, but it was like, she meant well.
I guess I'll go to TNA if
which
I
is
really
just, it's
work
funny
in
because in 2005, they go to TNA, and they did have a bit of a run with All Japan at the time, and then the next year, they did some shots with Hustle. And then after that, it was very sporadic appearances for New Japan because of the relationship. I mean, it was hardly like they were splitting their time during this decade between Japan and TNA. It was a very small portion. Their wrestling career was 95% TNA from 2005 to their return.
It's very interesting to see in 2016 kind of the company's stance on
companies outside of the WWE, and you can tell just from this year alone, they've really seemed to have relaxed their stance on Japan, almost even embracing Japanese professional wrestling with, you know, AJ Styles and the Bullet Club being very free to kind of talk about that. But even with TNA, they've been more relaxed about it, but certainly not to the same extent as they are Japan. So you can kind of tell their thinking is maybe that, like, we're fine to give credit to Japanese pro wrestling, but we don't want to give that much credit to another promotion that is still technically a competitor on our North American TV at the moment.
Yeah, and I think throughout this year, that stance is going to be relaxed even further in regards to TNA.
The gap is so huge now.
It's so massive that, what does it even mean to name TNA on a broadcast? It seems so silly. And on the flip side, when you have all of this talent that is coming in, ex-TNA talent, it behooves you to... It just makes sense that you build these guys up using their past history, because now they're your guys.
Yeah.
You have got the heart of TNA now in your roster.
I suppose the concern in the past with companies mentioning, with the WWE mentioning another company's name, is that any mention of another company's name, you're making that company now, you're making a viewer who might have never even heard of TNA now aware of what TNA actually is. And are you thus kind of perhaps losing a potential customer to another promotion? I think it's very silly. I don't think it's a concern anymore. But maybe that was the thinking back then.
Yeah, I just think the gap is ridiculous at this point. And I think that just look at the wave of all the ex-ROH talent that we have seen come in. And I think most fans are very familiar with ROH. And
ROH, they've never been kind of shy to...
No, mention. And to me that's...
Getting back to like the Matt Hardy Edge thing, right?
Right, which... Do you remember that story when there's a WWE PR person who was in our office the day after that angle happened and comes by? And this was when Matt Hardy does his big return and he yells Ring of Honor into the mic.
Yeah.
And it's just like, did you see the Matt Hardy thing last night? And I said, yeah, it was well done. He's like, well, congratulations on the ROH thing. It's like, congratulations. Like,
to you?
Yeah.
Congratulations to you.
I don't work
because the Fight Network was airing ROH?
Maybe that was why.
Oh, okay.
It was like, it means nothing to me. But whatever. Yeah. So that was interesting. And that was...
Congratulations. Like, we did you a big favor.
The cake's in the back. We're going to be having a party. All right. Back to our Dudley Boys DVD. They always do this kind of style where it's a current event which we interweave.
Ever since the Punk DVD.
Yes. It's always a present event that we are, or a recent event that kind of ties us all together to go back into the past. And this was their return the night after SummerSlam at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn and being hidden. And
In the bus. I think it's a format that really works, versus the way they used to do these DVD documentaries, which is just a very linear telling of the story. They always have, you know, a specific event, usually the last event. We saw it in the Daniel Bryan documentary. All the build up leading up to the main event of him making that presentation in the ring. In this case, it was the Dudley Boys making their return.
It's funny as we talk about AJ Styles, and if you were to do you look at TV right now, I would say this guy has greatly exceeded expectations at this point. I think pre-WrestleMania, people were still wondering, are they going to fully go with this guy? He has done tremendous during this Roman Reigns feud, and I think it's a matter of time they'll come out with a DVD. However, the hiccup there is, what do you fill that DVD with if it's matches?
You're going to have to wait a couple of years before I think you could do it.
Like, he does not have a library that you have accessibility to that you would have to really go out of your way to see.
Yeah, but you could have said the same thing about, you know, with Daniel Bryan or CM Punk, you know, prior to them having an extended run. I think AJ will probably take a couple of years before he builds that backlog of WWE events. Unless, of course, they, you know, acquire some libraries.
Yes, which you seem to be very, very gung-ho on.
I think it's inevitable, man. They're getting everybody.
If you are in the content-buying business, which is what the WWE is in, it makes all the sense in the world to purchase that TNA library.
Mm-hmm.
If it becomes available. Okay, so Devon explains how they are in his hometown. He had lived there between 1972 and 1988, and we kind of went back and forth between Devon and Bubba with a lot of their backstory, which I don't think is a very... they're not two guys that you know a whole ton about their early pre-wrestling days, how they got into the bit. Like, you knew they were fans of the of the product, of the WWWF. But this was interesting to hear from people around them as well.
I'll also say, I mean, I think a big part of the reason for that is because I don't know how much interest there existed prior to, you know, this documentary release of D-Von Dudley's history, or even Bubba Ray Dudley's history. The two of them...
You didn't care about the lineage of Reverend D-Von and the character?
No, I really didn't.
His stepfather?
And, you know, like... And they kind of get into this in the documentary. The two of them on their own... Bubba Ray Dudley kind of in recent years being the exception, but I'll say, you know, certainly in D-Von's case as a singles wrestler, hardly anything that special. What's special about both these guys is when you put them together, they're an exceptional tag team, and they'll admit that. They admit that on this documentary. So,
I think they actually overstated that point at times. I would agree with D-Von that he is certainly stronger as a part of the unit, and at a time, Bubba, I would say the same. However, Bubba separated himself during that TNA run, and he became a quality main event heel that I think he underscores himself or underestimates in this documentary, stating that we were just stronger together. I think today, if Bubba were to be splintered off as a heel, I think he would do very well.
I agree. I do agree. Though I suppose, like, what I mean is, you wouldn't see a Bubba Ray Dudley DVD. Like, he's not strong enough to be, you know, considered the level of mystique that the Dudley boys would be held at. And so I feel like the reason for this DVD is... You can't justify a D-Von DVD, nor could you justify a Bubba Ray Dudley DVD.
You wouldn't buy the Bubba Blu-ray? Bubba Blu-ray
That's
Dudley?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
I'm done.
But, you know, as a result of the two of them being so, you know, in such a prolific tag team, now you get the backstory of this guy, D-Von Dudley, or the backstory of Bubba Ray.
I never knew before this documentary that, according to his high school teacher, Laura Newman, D-Von had perfect attendance.
That's probably the way. I mean, I don't know how he actually, what his mom calls him, but
D-Von, get the tables
instead of D-Von.
How about the prom photos that we got from both of these guys? Some of these photos of them, in particular, Bubba. Here was a real life Biff Tannen. You could tell in high school.
Oh man,
just looked like the guy that you would hate at high school if you were some undersized nerd.
He was probably Bully Ray.
That was Bully Ray.
Yeah. Imagine if he could grow that mullet today.
Oh, man.
For that character. That would be great.
His Uncle Nick was interviewed.
Who's Uncle Nick?
Bubba's Uncle Nick.
Oh, okay.
He was interviewed. He explained he had a big Italian family. We heard from his cousin, Nicole. Greg Toop, his football coach, who predicted that Mark would grow up to either be a used car salesman or a pro wrestler, which kind of gave an idea of how Greg valued these two professions as being 1A and 1B in terms of, I guess, authenticity and ethical for this jerk that he coached on the football squad. But Bubba talked about how when he grew up and was a massive fan of the WWF, it was always the tag teams for him that piqued his interest, and he has always stated that he always grew up a fan of tag teams. And
seeing how four guys could have a better match than two.
Yeah, and I think that you compare that to a generation that is growing up that tag teams are, there's a mid-card ceiling to it, and it's inevitable you break them up and go off. And Bubba and D-Von grew up at a time where you could have a career as a tag team. And that's, I mean, if you can get a few years in this day and age out of a tag team, that's remarkable. I think the franchise teams like the Dudleys are going to be very, very few and far between. Then he talked about attending the Jimmy Snuka Don Morocco match, which featured the splash off the top of the cage, which WWE at their finest, finding Bubba in the crowd.
Yeah.
And they later did this with D-Von, too. I'm amazed at how they do this. I mean, even if you were to tell me I was in attendance at this show, to fucking pull up this video and find a young D-Von or Bubba in the crowd, which I think I would give up and just cheat and just highlight someone that just looks like him. I mean, no one's going to call you on it.
No, there's...
But it was so obvious then.
It's wonderful that
I think it's probably such a privilege for any performer to get the WWE production treatment for one of these documentaries, not only because they have all the footage. I mean, shit, they have footage of the time when these guys were kids in the crowd. They own the rights to that. But not only do you have this incredible archive of basically pro wrestling history, but you also have an excellent team of people producing and telling your stories. But yeah, of course, this was the same show that Tommy Dreamer was in and Mick Foley was in. But Bubba Ray had better seats than all of them. Front row, this kid.
Yeah, well, you know, he probably just used his muscle with a scalper, got some good tickets last minute. Mm-hmm. So, what an infamous event in WWF history, featuring future talent. Then he also talked about watching WrestleMania 3 on closed circuit at the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, and then they compared it with D-Von and his memories of Bob Backlund, John Studd, and just becoming obsessed with pro wrestling. And this is where they showed him in the crowd, and the two just, essentially, we just went back and forth about how they grew up. D-Von was a very prominent football player, but then quit in his senior year of high school, had a scholarship opportunity at Florida A&M that he turned down, and his family hated the idea of him going into professional wrestling. And then they even interviewed Johnny Rods, who they spoke with Tommy Dreamer, Taz. Tons of guys were interviewed for this, and it felt like original interviews, too, that they brought in Taz, they went and interviewed Johnny Rods, it looked like a new interview with Dreamer.
Yep, they all looked recent. RVD, Rhino.
No Paul Heyman in this, right?
Yeah, no, that's true.
Which is surprising.
Yeah,
that
interesting.
Because so much was focused on ECW that he seems like someone you would just automatically, even... You wouldn't even have to shoot new stuff. I would guarantee you they have tons of stuff in their library.
Well,
talking
like,
about the Dudley
Boys. It's not like the guy's hard to find. He's probably backstage, you know, quite often.
No, he was noticeably absent from this particular documentary. So they both had different stories about their training. D-Von went to Johnny Rods' school in the Northeast, and Bubba holds a grudge against his original trainer to the point he won't even say his name on this documentary, who basically burned him for his money and didn't know shit.
I like that a lot because I think so often you just hear in these documentaries people give so much credit and praise to whoever trained them. And, you know, they essentially become like father figures for a lot of these guys in their careers. But here's Bubba Ray, who pretty much had the exact opposite experience. Not only felt ripped off, but... felt like he wouldn't even be able to acknowledge and give credit to the guy by mentioning his name. I wonder who it was.
Yeah, everyone wants to know now.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, a lot of wrestling training schools have evolved from this, but I just always thought it was, listen, it's wonderful that you get taught the proper way, but I never agreed with this, you know, you owe me X percentage of all your earnings for the next X amount of years that so many trainers would. I mean, that was kind of the hustle of this. It's like you make a guy and then he owes you forever. And, you know, when I get those damn calls from Ryerson, it's like, oh, you're going to donate to the alumni fund? It's like, no, this transaction ended a decade ago. Mm-hmm. I paid you for an education. I did the work. I got a diploma at the end of it. Done. We don't owe each other anything anymore.
You should be calling Ryerson to ask for donations for your career.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm lending my good name to your alumni list.
Mm-hmm. We should erase that name of that school that you just mentioned.
I'm so mad I don't even want to talk about them. It's like, no, it's over. These guys paid to go to be trained. That was what you get out of it.
Yeah.
You get trained, you go on, and if you have a successful career, that's on you.
And in Bubba Ray's case, he said he was trained very improperly. He was...
basically learned on the job.
Yeah.
Yeah. So...
Which I might be able to say the same about my school.
Wow.
Experience.
Way
dropped. Well, I definitely learned on the job for anybody, you know, getting into broadcasting.
Oh, I think everyone. I mean, school's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's not going to give you, to me, a leg up on practical, on-the-job experience.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, we got into their early days, and this was Bubba Ray prior to being known as Bubba Ray when he was Mongo Vile, who was described as a fatter nasty boy by Tommy Dreamer. And
Mongo Vile.
Mongo Vile. If you could draw up the prototypical 400-pound early 90s indie wrestler, this was it. Mongo Vile.
Mongo Vile.
I swear, you looked at this guy. I don't know. I would have been pretty judgmental at the time. Me being a smartass, I would have looked at this guy and said, this guy will never amount to anything. And would have been completely wrong.
Yeah.
So he came in. He was not a fan of ECW because he saw it on television, thought it was awful. And then he was dragged by his friends to an ECW show. And being the pro that he was, brought his gear, brought his 8x10s, and he was ready in case they came calling. And sure as shit, they needed a guy to take a chokeslam from 911 and ended up being Bill Alfonso's bodyguard for the night. And he took the chokeslam, got over great, and they wanted to bring him in. Showed a lot of agility for someone that was... This guy looked pretty damn close to 400 pounds at the time. He was pretty large.
To see him in all this prior footage and then to see him cut back to present day being interviewed, you realize that this guy is in the best shape he's probably been in his entire life at this point in his career.
And Heyman proposed the idea of him shaving his head to be put in the Dudleys, clearly having the same reservations about his hair that most would have been.
I think the mullet would have worked great.
For the Dudleys as kind of your... Yeah.
Yeah.
It possibly could, mm-hmm. actually, for the kind of hillbilly, backwards mm-hmm. Dudley boys at the time. And, of course, that was Raven's idea, who was interviewed here, too.
Yep.
Fleeting appearances in this documentary, but Raven part of this as well. And he ended up joining Spike, Sign Guy, and Joey Styles, who were all interviewed in this. And they dedicated a significant portion here to an animation to explain the Dudleys' character and their dad working the circuit, going around the U.S., having a rat in every town, and fathering many offspring that would all come together.
Seemed like every Dudley got a bit of a shout-out here. They had an interview with Sign Guy.
Yeah, Lou DeAngeli.
Yeah. Snot Dudley.
Dances with Dudley.
Big Dick.
Big Dick.
Chubby Dudley.
They had them all covered here. And then Devon came into the fold in 1996 and feuded with Bubba. And it was on the recommendation of Johnny Rods when Taz called him up because they wanted... you know what? Heyman, I think, was... Was it Heyman who did describe this about the... No, maybe it wasn't. It was Taz who was explaining it. So never mind. There was no Heyman. And Taz called up Johnny Rods, said they needed an African-American for the Dudleys, and he recommended Devon for the spot.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think if Heyman was in this.
I think he actually was here because he was the one who explained that they wanted a cross between Samuel L. Jackson.
No, actually, it was Devon who explained that.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Okay, then he said Heyman wanted.
Yeah.
Okay. Someone can clarify. If we're wrong, I'm pretty damn sure Heyman was not interviewed at all on this. It was all secondhand Heyman stories.
If he was,
stories.
It must have not been a huge presence, you know, because I really don't remember.
So, yeah, the cross they wanted was Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction and Mr. T in Rocky III.
Mm-hmm.
What a marriage of characters.
Yeah.
And then
it makes sense when you think about it. The whole preacher.
Yep. Connect. Yep. And so the two feuded for a long time, had all of these... They put together a great montage of clips of these two just having their...
Killing each other.
Yeah. And... stress enough, like a very large Bubba Ray Dudley who moved around very well for his size. Mm-hmm. I mean, significantly bigger than today. And then the two finally aligned in February of 1997 after they did an angle where the Sandman had just beaten Devon, and then Spike and Bubba jumped into the ring, and then it was Bubba and Devon that aligned, and they attacked Sandman and delivered just an awful-looking 3D to Spike in the sense that, not that they missed it, but that his head came down into the mat, and I can't believe this guy didn't crack his vertebrae taking this 3D. It looked painfully awful.
And Bubba Ray's description of it was not hiding the fact that it was truly an ugly 3D the first time they ever did it.
He got spiked.
Yes, he did.
On his head.
Mm-hmm. It was a real death drop.
Yes. And the whole idea, Devon was supposed to be the more serious version of one of the Dudley sons, so
yes,
to speak.
And that was the basis of the initial feud, even. The
yes.
The fact that he was serious and hated how this Bubba Ray Dudley, who was always having fun and clowning around.
Doing the stuttering, and that did continue. But then they focused primarily on the heel run that Bubba and Devon had, and I really enjoyed this part where they talked about their ability to get heat with the crowd. They didn't want theme music. They said they wanted the theme music to be the boos of the crowd walking down. And I thought this was a great part. Bubba talks about, just says, cool bad guys suck. They wanted to be hated and despised. And that, to me, are always the best villains. The ones that don't want to have any of the cute lines. They don't want to be endearing in any which way to the audience. And that can certainly financially affect you, more so today than ECW in 1997, but I really enjoyed this, and just showing their ability to just get the hatred of the audience and have, they didn't need any filter when they were on the mic, and it was a very different version of the Dudleys than their comparison point when they went to the WWF that they would get into.
Who's around right now that you would consider, you know, somebody guilty of being a cool bad guy?
Oh, I think there's quite a few of them. I think just look at the WWE at this point. I think that who would be the best example?
And I just find it's an interesting idea, because how do you manage to be entertaining and not boring and not be X-Pac, but not be overly cool to the point where it's detrimental?
Here's the one that comes to mind immediately for me, was Triple H in a lot of the key angles building up WrestleMania this year. I mean, look at the end of the Rumble, where he was presented as the badass that's just eliminating everyone, crotch chopping.
It was all, that was also weird, though, because it was against Roman Reigns.
But the plan was not to turn Roman Reigns, nor was it to turn Hunter into a babyface. But that was how it came across, and that was someone that, why were those crotch chops in there? It was done for no other reason. That's an instant babyface spot when Hunter does that. So that would be one. I think you go back to the NWO, that was a massive problem, because Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, I think there were times, Hogan, too, there were a lot of them at that point, where they did become the cool heels. And it was, and the WCW babyfaces came off as much less cooler. Even Sunday night, the ROH pay-per-view, I mean, the Bullet Club, for all the heat they tried to get, it was very much still, it's like the audience, they love the Young Bucks in particular. And it's very hard for the crowd to hate the Young Bucks, and that's going to be a major struggle in this angle, if that's the goal, to make them this villainous group, when the Young Bucks, so much of it is that they are cool heels. That is their gimmick. And they break all the rules. So the Dudleys had a great discussion here about their whole mindset of this particular time period.
There's also a lot of emphasis on the fact that they felt like they were successful because the two of them were so different and they complemented each other very well. And, I mean, I think that's also obviously another very understated part of what makes, I think, tag team wrestling so, you know, interesting. And I feel like it gets lost on a lot of the teams that you see today, particularly, you know, coming out of NXT, for instance, like The Ascension. Can you tell me what's different about Connor and Victor? Like, stylistically, on the microphone, is there any difference?
Okay, we will get to Connor, because he was interviewed for this. But we also had Bubba comparing what they did at the ECW shows. He said, we wanted to have a feel of it being a Sex Pistols or Ramones show, where anything could happen, they would challenge the audience to fights, and they go through all of this. We had RVD briefly interviewed in his WWE t-shirt, looking very Rob Van Dam-like. And we also had Rhino and Lance Storm. They really went overboard. Maybe not overboard, but man, they didn't spare any expense here.
And this must have been a different, because we know Lance recently went in for the Edge and Christian show.
This wouldn't have been that quick a turnaround. Yeah. And then we go into their move to the WWE, which was brokered by photographer Black Jack Brown, who was also interviewed.
Wow. Amazing. So, imagine the cost of flights.
I watched like 20 minutes of it over the weekend, because the WWE Network has put up the new Click documentary. And
a new one?
It was the DVD they put out year ago or a couple months back.
Yeah, I think I've seen that.
Yeah, I think they put up one of those 30-minute first look things, and now the whole thing's up. So I was just watching like 20 minutes of it, and they're showing the curtain call, and they fucking interview the fans that shot it on the camcorder.
Yeah, it was great.
I love that, that stuff. I want to hear from the Blackjack Browns and the fans that shot the curtain call. Mm-hmm. I think those are really cool guests and different talking heads to hear from.
Yeah.
So anyway, Blackjack Brown, this was hilarious. The WWE was interested, but they didn't want to call the Dudleys, and the Dudleys didn't want to call the WWE and be approaching them for a job. They said, if they want us, then they can call us. So,
it's like two people who want to date each other but don't really want to admit it.
Yeah, there was no wrestling Tinder at the time to just make it easier and put a third party in. It was Blackjack Brown at the time who swiped for them and then conferenced in Vince Russo. And they were really proud of the fact that neither side made the first phone call. They were conferenced in by Blackjack Brown. If I have to describe pro wrestling with one story, that is it.
I almost half expected and was a little disappointed when we didn't get a Vince Russo appearance in this documentary.
Well, he's all over the Click documentary, so I mean they were brought in. I will say this about Vince Russo. There are few talkers that are as captivating as Vince Russo. This guy will take whatever and just make it sound like this was the biggest thing ever. I mean, he's describing the curtain call and it's just like amazing. Amazing. But we're getting off into another review, so we won't do that. This is where we cut back out of the transition to the WWF to the present in Brooklyn. And D-Von is giving a very specific direction on how he wants his sleeves cut on his t-shirt to the seamstress and explains how their merchandise during their heel run in ECW barely sold because they were so hated. And that was, you know, a factor with a lot of heels of the time was that, of course, when you are significant heels, it definitely affects your merchandise. It was something that Triple H talked about when he left DX and wanted to go heel, was you take a massive hit in the merchandise department when you leave something very successful on the babyface side. And the second interview, we go back to the 1999 time period. Their second interview with the WWF was with Vince McMahon and Jim Ross and Stanford, and the Dudleys are explaining their act and that we are old school heels. We don't do autographs and we don't do photos. And Bubba explains how Vince just leaned over, put his hand on his knee and said, "You guys will do that stuff here." And Bubba said, "Yeah, you're right, we will." And that was that. So the Dudleys were at least open to being changed. And at this time in 1999, the Dudleys were certainly looked upon as how are they going to adapt to even the WWF being as edgy as they were at the time. It was a far cry from some of the stuff that the Dudleys were doing in ECW at the time that was just not going to fly on the USA Network.
They get into a big portion of their debut was kind of almost clouded over by the fact that Public Enemy had come and gone in the WWE, you know, without much fanfare, and in fact, almost politically, did not do the Dudleys any favors.
No, they just compared them as just a second coming of Public Enemy.
So do you remember, like, back at the time when the Dudleys were announced to come into the WWE, what were your expectations, and did you have the same comparisons?
You know, one of the things at the time that is never focused on in this is the fact that Joel Gertner became a big part of the Dudleys' act and doing their introductions, and it certainly enhanced Joel Gertner, and he was not part of the Dudleys act coming over to the WWF. I thought that the Public Enemy, I think everyone knew what their strengths and weaknesses were, and I think they came in to the company and they were not protected very well. And the APA thing that they outline here, where, you know, the story has always been that they were supposed to do this spot, and then just before the match they told them they weren't doing it. And they were like, "Fuck these guys." And we pretty much got that story intact, and they beat the shit out of them on television, which I don't know how open I would be if I was a WWE producer wanting to promote this fact that we just took liberty. Two of our guys took liberties, and how great it was.
This was an incredible – I thought this was an incredible portion of the documentary, especially for 2016, where the WWE basically admits to a live hazing on TV – multiple times in the form of the APA, attacking both Public Enemy and also attacking the Dudleys in a backstage skit.
Public Enemy were a tremendous... During their peak run in ECW, were an incredibly over tag team, and they were at their peak in ECW. And then we saw as they went to WCW and then WWF, they were not protected in those promotions, and it ended up that they were just, they largely were written off as a product of Paul Heyman in ECW, who understood the timing of that tag team, the way they connected, utilizing the tables, and they became a very overact, and then in the hands of other promotions, that they were not given those same luxuries. And that's, you know, unfortunate, because I thought that they did have their strengths. I think in particular, Rocco Rock was a very underappreciated talent. And yeah, the Dudleys essentially benefited off of all of the bad feelings Public Enemy left with them, that the Dudleys came in and they had completely different attitudes, and they were willing to take their lumps from the APA, got their respect, and were embraced by the locker room very quickly. But it was a good snapshot at the time of kind of these locker rooms that you saw even more of during the invasion, where it was just, it's these kinds of pettiness, to be honest, that, you know, you come in and you don't shake the right hand, or you don't say hi to the right person, and you're doomed.
Or if you complain after taking a beating.
Or if you upgrade your coach ticket to a first class air flight ticket, you're dead.
Yeah. So this story with the Dudleys making their debut against the APA, I found very interesting. I mean, basically, they were about to get into a live initiation. Like a frat house initiation on live TV.
Yep, and that's how it was. And they interviewed Edge and Christian, and they pretty much explain the circumstances of the Public Enemy and I guess the trepidation the locker room had about the Dudleys coming in. And for those of them, I think, that even followed them in ECW, wondering how they were going to fit into this very different product. And yeah, we went through the APA, who kind of gave them the thumbs up afterwards. And JBL and Ron Simmons, both interviewed for this, put them over big. They agreed to work physical when they were in there. And then the Dudleys, they started changing the gimmick around to reflect the change, which I think were positive changes. They got rid of the stuttering for Bubba, which he did start off in the WWF with. Mm-hmm. And then they, one day Vince just told them to change their look, and that's where they came up with the camo outfits that they continued with. And then it was 2000 that you saw the turnaround. I think the fall of 1999 was those two just trying to find their place in the company. And then in 2000, when you paired them with the Dudley, with the Hardys, and later Edge and Christian, that was certainly when they took off. Mm-hmm. And that takes us to the Rumble and the tables match they had at Madison Square Garden, which was a really outstanding pay-per-view, which this kicked off the show and featured that Jeff Hardy swanton and some crazy spots in this match. Bubba falling backwards off the balcony through a table. I mean, yeah, there was just some...
This was the opener.
This was the opener of that pay-per-view, which mm-hmm. also featured that Triple H Cactus Jack street fight and Mae Young.
Oh.
So it had its highs and lows that year at the Rumble. So it was a match that...
which we've reviewed, I'm pretty sure.
The Rumble 2000, I'll take your word for it. Yeah. I think so. And then they followed that with the ladder match at WrestleMania 2000 involving Edge and Christian, and I really enjoyed all of this because they had we heard from Edge, Christian, Bubba, D-Von, the mystery team was not referenced. Well, they were referenced, but they were certainly not heard from.
Inaccessible for this documentary. But I think a large portion, I would say, I feel like they're, as far as their WWE tenure, I'd say probably maybe in their whole careers, for all three of these teams, I feel like this was probably the peak in what they were, their lasting legacies as teams.
Oh, as teams, yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, certain guys would go on to have much bigger singles careers, but this was a huge, this was these three teams breaking out of the pack, and they changed that tag division. You look at 1999, and it was a division that the Hardys were in the title picture, but you had teams like the APA, and, you know, it was just, it wasn't the tag division that the 2000 year and onward became, because these three teams certainly transformed that team, that division.
And to see, you know, a team like the Dudleys kind of talking about TLC, I think is...
I wouldn't personally just group this as, you know, an extension of sort of the hardcore match. I felt like what made these TLC matches stand out and these ladder matches stand out was the fact that they were incredibly creative. You know, it wasn't just people hitting over the head with chairs or whatnot. It was really great setups and really creative, you know, payoffs to a lot of very impressive looking stunts.
I think they benefited from the hardcore division because people had that comparison point. These were not the cookie sheet to the head matches. Mm-hmm. These were very elaborate, extremely dangerous matches, yeah. But you had some brilliant minds that were piecing all of this together. Mm-hmm. I think Edge certainly gets a lot of credit as a guy that was able. One of the smarter guys when it came to structuring matches, Matt Hardy, I would put in there as well. And I don't doubt Bubba had a ton. Those are three right there. Mm-hmm. Very smart guys when it came to putting these kinds of matches together. And they built upon them from the WrestleMania 2000 match, which definitely stole the show. It was a very lackluster WrestleMania. That was certainly the best match of that card. And then they increased it with the first TLC match at SummerSlam that year, which was in North Carolina. And the Hardys were originally pegged to win that match, and then they made the decision Edge and Christian would win in the Hardys' home state. So, and they just kind of talk about the six of them. They would lay out stuff, and then it was just constantly trying to one-up themselves as they talked about TLC 2 at WrestleMania 17, and they all kind of acknowledged that this was the one where they felt a lot of pressure because of this being such a massive show. You had this was a show where there was tons of competition for who was going to have the best match of the show, and this, I would not say this was the best match of that show, but that was an extremely loaded one.
A lot of people would say it was the best.
Some would. Yeah, I mean, some would.
It depends what type of wrestling you're more invested in, yeah, and more interested in.
They were a huge part of the show.
A lot of people do feel TLC 2 was the most the best show at the best WrestleMania of all time.
And I think that was really the peak of these kinds of matches, yeah, because they came out with so many TLCs after this that are even close to as well remembered as the first two.
TLC 3 was very good, but certainly
TLC 3 was on television.
Yeah, but it was a very good match, but certainly not at the level of these ones. I definitely say that this was, you know, the height of the TLC ladder match. But also keep in mind, they really ran through these pretty quickly, you know, between 2000 and 2001 with the number of matches that they had. They burnt themselves out, I'd say, like quite often, or quite quickly with this gimmick.
And I think that all of these six really, from 2001, I thought it was years that these guys were able to separate themselves from. They were always going to be tied to these matches, and that extended to Edge in his singles career, Jeff Hardy in his singles career, and I think they overcame that. But it became very difficult because people anticipated big things whenever these guys were linked to future ladder matches. And I think all of, especially Edge and Jeff Hardy, I think they overdid it with the amount of ladder matches. And I think it certainly impacted Edge's career, where he did all of this stuff to get to a point, and then once he was there, they still wanted him, you know, when it was a big feud, mm-hmm, they would do singles TLC matches, whether it was Cena or it was other ladder matches, they would have that. I mean, it took a real toll on these guys, and I think they all would admit that as well. But these matches and these three teams, they all got themselves over to a different level because of these matches. So it was a catch-22, I feel. And they mention in the TLC 2 match the introduction of Lita, Spike Dudley, and Rhino, who had all been introduced on, well, Lita for a while, but Spike and Rhino had just come over from ECW, so they had that new wrinkle to the match. And Edge stating that it was miraculous that no one died during any of these matches, which is always a great thing you can look back and say. And Bubba said it could not get any higher after TLC 2 and was really the resurgence for the tag division. And they kind of just left it there. They didn't talk about all the subsequent TLC matches they did with other different variations.
Benoit won the third one, and TLC 4 was like Kane.
Kane and the Hurricane, and yeah, and that was one where Bubba got a nasty concussion in, and yeah, once you were doing these matches on television, I think it was just really, you were getting a little desperate. TLC 3 was notable because they just announced it out of nowhere, yeah, on a SmackDown, mm-hmm, and it didn't do some crazy number either that they anticipated, and I think that was really That was the match where Benoit totally fucked up his neck and needed the surgery afterwards, and it just became... The bar was raised so high that you did need it to inevitably take that step back. So, D-Von shared a story about taping his fingers, which he got from Ron Simmons.
Mm-hmm.
These are things you never knew before, right?
I thought these were a little cool.
I like them, too. Yeah.
To the backstage.
And that's where they also explained the camo gear and Vince just wanting them to ditch the tie-dye. And then we go into the brand split of 2002, where Vince McMahon wanted something big, and something big was splitting up the Dudley Boys, which was a disaster.
To hear it explained this way, I mean, I feel like something as big as splitting up any tag team, hopefully you're doing it for a good reason with a long-term plan for where you want both men to go. But the way it was described here, it just sounded like Vince wanted... a pop for this brand split, and you know, why not just let's just do this for
yeah
one night.
And we got, well, the Reverend D-Von character, which D-Von really enjoyed this character. He said he thought it had a lot more, but I think he admits it did not work.
They were dancing around. They're all being really nice about it.
They were.
Taz was like, "Oh, I got a real kick out of it." But
yeah, I know. I think everyone admits it didn't work. But I think D-Von had higher hopes for it when it started, and it's largely just remembered as the punchline for Batista's introduction onto the main roster as Deacon Batista.
But on the other hand, I was very disappointed in Bubba Ray's babyface run.
I wasn't a big proponent of breaking up the team, but it was also all three of those teams, the Hardys, Edge and Christian, and the Dudleys, you could all sense that the tag run was over, and what are we going to do next? And it goes back to that mentality that especially the WWE has, in that once you've reached a certain level, you break up the team. You don't stay together forever. And I think the Dudleys were hurt the most. The Hardys, while I saw a potential in those two as singles, they really struggled. Even Edge and Christian. Edge had a big upside, and they were most behind as a singles guy. He did not get over at first to the level I think they anticipated in as a singles guy.
No.
But the Dudleys, like Bubba was just, I don't know, this did not work. I thought the fact that it was the brand split where you had more focus for guys like that, that was working for him. But, I mean, he was working in a baseball jersey with these track pants.
Yeah,
and it
was
just
bad. They've turned him into a generic hardcore division wrestler.
Yes.
And they get into it here in the documentary where they basically said, oh, now that we're singles guys, we can't do any of our spots. We can't do the headbutt. We can't do the 3D. We can't even do the tables. We can't really do anything that made fans want to cheer us.
Yeah, and it ended up that Bubba then pretty much after the singles run was very short, and then it was a lot of the time he was just paired with Spike, and they were like, it was the light version of the Dudley Boys. Mm-hmm. After that, it really didn't work, and at least to the company's credit, they realized this didn't work, and they reunited them at the Survivor Series that year, which did get a very big reaction at Madison Square Garden.
It did, but man, I just wish that there was a lot more, foresight into making that decision, because I think it really hurt the two of them. Even after you reunited the two of them back together, it's like a failed relationship, you know, where
you broke up and then you got back together. Yeah. And it's like, well,
oh, you're the best.
There was a reason you broke up to start with that has not been addressed.
And you're also, you know, looking at it like, I tested the waters and you're the best I could do, so I'm going to stick with you.
Yeah, it's very tough. It's like when Coach Taylor took the job at TMU on Friday Night Lights, and then after three episodes, they're like, nah, you're going to go back to Dillon High.
Sure.
I knew that's what you were thinking.
Yeah.
So Bubba says there were not a lot of teams when they reunited, and we just erased 2003 and 2004, and we go right to their contracts expiring in July of 2005.
Well, in reality, what significant events took place in the careers of the Dudley Boys?
They murdered Paul Bearer. He was cemented in history. I mean, they became like almost main event guys on the SmackDown brand when SmackDown was really awful, I thought, in 2004. The feuds you think of, La Resistance during the Iraq War when France were the heels on the show, represented by Rene Dupree, Sylvain Grenier, and Rob Conway. And that was it. They feuded with Lance Storm and Val Venus. I mean, they were very much in just support roles and forgotten about on Raw. I mean, hardly the prominence they had during that 2000 to 2002 period. So we go to July, and it's always been the Dudleys have always clarified this, and they are right. Their contracts were expiring, and they were just going to agree to leave after the contracts were up. I think that was probably a combination of a lot of things, whether they didn't have ideas for them, whether WWE wanted to cut ties with them. The contracts were up, and they did a massive dump and just announced all these cuts, and they included the Dudleys in these cuts, which, you know, they have always clarified. We were not fired. Our contracts were up, and we went our separate ways, and that was kind of explained here. But on the website, they were just lumped with everybody, and it was kind of similar to the Wade Barrett deal from last week, where he had given notice. His contract was up in June. He's going to leave, and then they just cut him a month earlier. And
yeah. A technical, you know, obviously, do you believe they would have actually, I don't know. The way they made it sound like here, they wanted them to take less money, apparently. And it seemed like creatively the WWE had nothing for these guys anyway.
You know, you certainly get the sense based on just what you could see here. They didn't have a ton of ideas. They wanted to cut their money. I could see why both sides wanted to just walk away at this point. Mm-hmm. I think at the time, I believe I had interviewed D-Von, and he pretty much, you know, stated that it was some conflict with John Laurinaitis at the time that they kind of positioned it. And I think it made sense for both to probably, because they really, there was nothing going on for them. They appeared at that one night stand show in June, and they were in a featured spot. Yeah. They were in the main event slot on there. That was a big part for them. But on TV, I mean, one night stand was not really attached to WWE storytelling, and they didn't have a whole lot of ideas for them.
As far as splits go, you know, in your opinion, did you think that the Dudleys would have ever made a return to the WWE at this point in time? Or did you think that it was, you know, a relationship that was done?
Well, good. I mean, it's funny here in the DVD how they just, they position it like it was just, you know, super, both sides so loved amicable. Each other, yeah. And they moved on.
They sent emails to each other thanking each other.
Yeah, and then when they wanted to move on, the WWE refused to allow them to use their name outside, and they were facing a pretty nasty legal fight because the Dudleys believed that they had had the right since they had used this name back in ECW before the WWE. And then when the WWE bought all of the intellectual property in bankruptcy court, the Dudley boys were part of that. And then they had to come up. They decided rather than going through the legal battle with the WWE that would cost a lot, they just simply renamed themselves. And at first they were going to be the Deadly Boys and then settled with Team 3D.
No, I think I'd prefer Team 3D.
I don't think it really mattered. But that was going to be the idea. It would be you would have... Yeah, the Deadly Boys.
Okay.
And that takes us to the four-minute chapter on their next 10 years, which was going to TNA, where they showed up on the very first Impact on Spike.
It's really incredible that these two actually spent more time in TNA than they did in the WWE.
Oh, a whole lot more time. I mean, they were there 6 years in WWE. And
that goes for Kurt Angle as well. I'm sure a number of guys that you... But when you think of their body of work, you really just think of their WWE work.
Yeah, that's a weird deal in general with TNA in terms of how they...
It's a bigger stage when you're in the WWE.
Well, of course it's a bigger stage, but I think that's something when if you were to go and list all of the top 25 matches Kurt Angle had in the WWE for a shortened period of time versus his top 25 matches in TNA. He's had way more great matches in TNA than WWE. But you ask the average person...
How many have
just
you
Just ask me, what are your favorite Kurt Angle matches? I guarantee you they're going to rattle off WWE matches.
Yeah.
Whether you're a viewer of TNA or not. And that's just something about... I think there's something that just... There's very few things in TNA's history that leave that lasting impression. Joe and Angle being one of them. So they talk a bit about Bubba getting into shape, losing 100 pounds, becoming the TNA champion, and he mentioned getting to work with the likes of Hulk Hogan and Sting, and pretty much that Bubba really rose to prominence in TNA, and D-Von really didn't enjoy his time there.
D-Von stayed at home. I would have killed for
I would have loved to mention Aces and Eights somewhere around here, but no, nothing like that. So, you know, to dance, I was curious to know, to see how they would have danced around kind of the use of TNA footage, and they obviously didn't have any TNA
footage. We got a still photo of a nondescript environment.
We had a couple still photos of what looked to be a TNA house show in some type of outdoor
arena. It was all dark.
It was like all gray skies. So this seemed like it was in some, like, one of their house shows in like a baseball diamond or something. And this was pretty much the extent of all the TNA B-roll that they had.
So it's they did address TNA. What a stupid thing! Like, just the way it's like it's become a thing. It's like, oh man, is WWE going to mention TNA?
I don't think it's stupid. I think it's kind of cool for, you know, it's as a wrestling fan, you know, it's because they've been so protective of, you know, their boundaries for so long. I think it's always interesting. It's like Spider-Man appearing in Captain America. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Something that's not supposed to happen, but.
Yeah, and the way, as I mentioned before, Bubba made this, you know, he said, we went to TNA, but it was also our ability to go work Japan, and we could do both at the same time, which, as I mentioned, they did spend a bunch of time in All Japan throughout the latter half of 2005, and then Hustle the following year, but then after that, it was just, you know, they made a bunch of appearances for New Japan, but they were hardly, you know, doing a ton of dates in Japan during this entire TNA run. TNA was the lion's share of their work during this time away from WWE. And we got the return to television of Terrence and Terrell.
Yeah.
The Devon's son. So they're doing well now after joining the Pope. They're back with Devon now. And then they chatted about the Team 3D Wrestling Academy.
They didn't show Devon's fake wife, though.
No. He just mentioned an ex-wife in passing, woman he was married to. And discusses the Team 3D Wrestling Academy. So we got a mini infomercial in there for the school.
Lou Pants.
Leva Bates was interviewed there. Yeah. And they showed...
Who else has come from that school?
They had... at the 3D Academy.
In TNA, like, who was there? Wasn't that the one-legged guy?
Yeah, what was his name?
Chris.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I'll look it up.
Yeah, you look it up.
Anyone else come to mind?
There's been a few. There was Jay Rios was interviewed here. He's done some shots for TNA.
Chris Melendez.
Chris Melendez. That was the name I was stuck on. Yeah, he hasn't been on television in probably a year for TNA. Okay. So then we go to kind of the reconciliation of the Dudley Boys and the WWE, and it was quite the retelling of the Royal Rumble in 2015, where it started with an email from the Road Dogg for Bubba and Bubba alone to appear in the Royal Rumble. And Bubba comes out number 3. It's in Philadelphia, got an enormous reaction.
How long had he been off of TNA at this point?
Oh, at this point, it was it had only been a few months at this point. And then he actually did go back to TNA shortly after this for that commissioner role that he was only there for a very brief amount of time. So Bubba comes out, huge reaction as a surprise, and we got all the spots that R-Truth performed as Devon Dudley.
Yeah.
He got to be the guy playing the role of Devon, and this looked so stupid.
Why?
Because you wanted to do all the Devon spots, but we weren't going to use Devon.
Yeah.
So we found R-Truth.
This was the Royal Rumble. You only had a couple spots.
I'm sorry. It looked really silly that we're just going to have a fellow black wrestler play Devon Dudley.
Yeah.
That was what R-Truth's role was, play Devon.
Fine.
And the whole crowd started chanting Devon. And Devon's at home saying this was really good because at least they were chanting for him and they positioned it as well. Clearly, they're going to bring us back because of this reaction.
The fact that it was another black wrestler chosen to lift the
just
guy
just a coincidence,
up for,
right? If Damian Sandow was there,
whatever. But the fact that they managed to fit the 3D into, you know, the Royal Rumble, I thought received a great reaction from myself personally watching it.
I mean, I do agree it would have been a little convoluted if it was Bubba number 3 and Devon number 5 coming out. I think you wouldn't have got the same reaction for Devon when Bubba had just come out for that reaction. So Anyway.
And D-Von, I mean, he wasn't even in TNA for a long time. It wasn't known if he was an active performer, even.
D-Von had last appeared, I want to say, well, he had the contract dispute in 2012, and then he came back and was in Aces of N8s. And my best recollection was, of course, him chugging the beer with Mr. Anderson.
Yeah.
So that was kind of his last kind of tenure with the company, as I recall.
Maybe we'll get an Aces and Eights reunion with Doc Gallows now.
There's many, many options.
Yeah.
I mean, Wes Briscoe's out there, Garrett Bischoff.
Yeah.
Plenty of possibilities.
This should be the new Bullet Club.
Yeah. And then they got different reactions from Edge, Spike Dudley, another guy they interviewed for this, Mick Foley, Christian, all talking about their reaction in Brooklyn. And the best part of this was that, I mean, so many performers, you always hear the same story, whether they're out for a long time with an injury or they're making a return. It's like, I just hope they remember me. And what's the reaction going to be like? Well, not Bubba Ray Dudley. He just flat out says in the gorilla position before they go out, we have no doubt it's going to be a massive reaction. They're going to go crazy. It's a big surprise. There is no fear from Bubba Ray Dudley what this crowd is going to react to. And as they walk to the gorilla position, the look on Becky Lynch's face and then Charlotte, who were just genuinely surprised. Here are the Dudley Boys TNA fame here in our locker room.
Yeah, this was really cool to see. Just the cameras following them backstage and seeing the live reactions of the performers to this genuine surprise like everybody had. And I think, it just really goes to show you the lengths that they will go to hide these surprises even from their own performers.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the standard one, which the Chris Jericho one was really funny when his last return was where he came back and he told the story on his podcast, how he was put in the bus all day and he was trying to avoid everything.
It's a nice bus, though. You could see from
the
inside.
It's very nice.
It's huge.
But then he's backstage and he sees the rundown of the show and he's just listed in the, like, he's not hidden in the script or anything. It's like, it was hardly the surprise. It was almost like this was a joke on Jericho that they're going to pretty much put him in a prison for the whole show, when it was like they were doing nothing to try and keep this. Yeah, I mean, it was widely known that he was coming back, at least to the backstage crew. So they made their big return, interrupting the New Day. Once again, this was the night after SummerSlam. Bubba mentioned an email that he had sent Vince McMahon in July of 2005 because he didn't get to say goodbye in person, and Vince replied to them. And I just love the idea of, like, Vince on his computer, like, responding to an email and making sure his Norton antivirus is running, and replied, calling them team players, and they just had nothing for them at the time, and they would work again, and don't you even think of calling yourselves the Dudley Boys. But this is when we have Connor and Victor, who were interviewed for this documentary, and maybe on the surface it was just the idea of two current guys on the roster. This was the most I've ever seen out of Connor. This guy was the biggest Dudley Boys fan, and he was so excited to be interviewed on this documentary. And he tells this story about locking up with Bubba in a match, and under his breath he tells Bubba what a big fan of his he is, right before taking a 3D. And it ends with Connor asking the interviewer, "Is this over? Because I could talk about these guys all day long." And it was just a really nice moment. It's like, this guy has shown more personality in these, like, 60 seconds he was interviewed on this DVD than he has shown in a year and a half on the main roster.
Yeah, I mean, I have no doubt that he's got a lot of personality, both these guys, but I think that gimmick, they just don't know how to write for.
I will say it's the same gimmick they had in NXT, but in NXT they were not comedy, where they were just these goofs that were essentially a parody of an 80s monster tag team, where that is what they have always been positioned as on the main roster. And not to say the gimmick is necessarily a winner, but it worked a lot more in NXT than it did in WWE. And I feel these guys, they were not even given a shot to fail. It was like they were brought up as a joke to begin with, and that's how they've always been, and they've gone nowhere on the main roster. And not to say these are guys that could be massive parts of the show, but you question why they're even here when this company has no ideas for them, and they were never even given a shot. And I could see you being, it's one thing to go out there and, you know, you're given a fair chance to get over. I thought they were never even given a shot from day number one. They were just, you know, those silly promos where they're just yelling at the camera. Very goofy. So anyway, it ends with Bubba saying he is much more laid back and smarter this time around with the WWE. And they end it by a lot of the talent calling them the greatest tag team of all time. Bubba disagrees with this. He feels the greatest of all time are the Road Warriors or the Rock and Roll Express, and he will never say that they are the best tag team of all time. But note that it's now been 20 years since they started out as a team back in ECW when D-Von was introduced, and that's how the documentary ends. So while it's only an hour and 15 minutes, they do cram a lot into this. I thought they hit on the key things. And realistically, they did the TNA chapter when you don't have any footage of it, when you don't have people there that really worked with them all that much. There wasn't a whole lot you were going to do. So they maybe did more than I thought they would on TNA, but they at least addressed it. I think more could have been focused on Bubba's heel run. But again, in TNA, you have nothing to really back that up with. But I think that when you talk about these two, you really got the sense like they don't have any plans to ever break this team up when you watch something like this. And I think that Bubba, they could do something with.
I feel like those decisions can be made always, you know, on a whim. And I would still love to see a Bully Ray heel run in the WWE. But I would say that I think for the time being, I think they're doing pretty good jobs as a heel tag team. I thought the length was more than sufficient. You know, an hour and 15 minutes, you told their whole story, and I don't think they really left anything glaring out. So I was very satisfied with the documentary.
I give this documentary, I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
It was pretty good. I liked, you know, they interviewed a ton of people for this project. I liked a lot of the photos that they dug up of their early formative years, and covered a lot in that hour and 15 minutes. I wouldn't say this was the best documentary the company has ever put out, but I thought this was a good representation of the team and covered a lot of different areas of their careers.
Yeah, I thought it was very solid. I thought probably like the best job you could possibly do with the Dudley Boys DVD without the TNA footage, I'd say. So I personally give it a 7.5 out of 10.
All right, we're going to go to some feedback here before we round things out. Ronaldo from Milan writes, to be honest, I didn't find this one-hour documentary as riveting as, say, a regular episode of WWE 24, on which I think this belonged more than an actual DVD. Nothing to say against the actual subject, but the way WWE chose to tell these guys' story was just bland. I don't mean to say you have to have a dramatic, tragic event in the middle of the documentary to make it appealing, but the whole line of the whole thing was basically, guys won a lot of titles and they are the greatest tag team in the world, second only to the Road Warriors, which documentary was a lot more interesting than this. Surely they named TNA, but that only shows how little they actually care about the organization. All in all, not the worst they've pulled out of nothing. You should go out of your way to watch.
Okay, we go to Kai, who says, I've got more of a question for you guys than feedback, but it's still Dudley related. Why do you think WWE have never really gotten behind the singles run for either guy? We saw in TNA that both could do it, Bubba being the obvious standout, and they did kind of try in 2002, but one had a bad gimmick while the other stated he messed up and nearly injured Triple H on a Raw, so they stopped things. I've just found it interesting that they've kept them as a tag team, which in fairness they do need, but they still could do singles roles while staying together, and someone like a Bubba Ray could be a big benefit in the higher-level heel role.
I would say they're both. D-Von, when they split them up in TNA, I think everyone had the same concerns when they split up in TNA that it was going to be a repeat of 2002, but we saw what Bully Ray turned into. Tremendous success. D-Von also was, I mean, he really got in great shape towards the end in TNA, and he was more than passable as a singles performer at the time. I think if they were to do it today, I think Bully Ray could be a significant heel that they could go with just because of the depth issues, and he's a guy that can talk. I think it would be night and day from 2002. With D-Von, I get the sense he would flounder.
Yeah.
As a babyface or a heel. I could be wrong, but that's that would be my sense of things. And I think at this point, it would all be dependent on if you really did need a new heel for Bully Ray. Because at this point, I think it is a fresh coat of paint that they're in the heel role as a tag team. You do have a lot more teams now to work with for them. It's not like it's just this empty landscape. I think they helped Enzo and Cass tremendously well during their first few weeks and the way they helped those guys. So there's certainly I feel they're fine in this role now, but I think Bully Ray personally, I think he is a guy that could be utilized a whole lot better as a singles heel.
Mm-hmm. At least initially, I feel like part of their hesitation might be the fact that, I mean, if you're talking to Vince McMahon here, that he will only recognize the Dudley Boys as, you know, what they only for their contributions in the WWE. And in their contributions in the WWE, he's seen that these two are great as a tag team and they suck as singles guys. He probably is completely unaware of TNA. Though I will definitely say, like, in recent years, you know, with other people around Vince McMahon, I'm sure they're more than aware of Bully Ray's abilities that he's developed in TNA. So I could definitely see that changing. But I feel also that I don't know how long I expect the Dudleys to even stay in the WWE. I really feel like their current run is more so to come in to help their young talent get to that level.
So far, that's been it.
They've jobbed to basically everybody. But again, they've managed to, because they're so over, yep, it hasn't really hurt them at all. But I believe their role at this point is to help that young tag team division. And I feel like it'll take maybe a bit of a level of desperation on the heel side for, and also Devon's exit to, you know, finally get that Bully Ray singles heel character again.
Well, I think it's super important, especially with the WWE, that you see the amount of young talent that they are bringing up from NXT. I think it is so important to have your Dudleys and your Chris Jerichos and guys like that in the locker room to help these younger guys. Yeah. I think those people are so valuable. And that more than any would, to me, justify the Dudleys staying around to work with these teams that maybe have never been on national television before. Like, I think they're a great enhancement to be working with Enzo and Cass on the road. I think it'll help them tremendously well. Finally, we go to Fernando, who writes, their involvement in the early 2000s WWF tag scene is, with no question, the high peak of the Dudley Boys. This documentary is very similar to the Sting one in working backwards and telling their history, but also including their most recent return or debut. It was quite pointless for Bubba to go back to TNA after the Rumble appearance and then leave. Two questions. Is there any merit to Bubba's claims that they were not fired in 2005 and it was only a mutual split? Yes, their contracts were legitimately up at the time. And number two, do you guys know if it was political maneuvering by Bubba to be the hottest babyface in TNA during the 2014 New York shows that summer by getting the Dixie table spot there and beating the Hardys the following week? Well, I don't know if you're discussing if Bubba had a lot of creative direction input. He certainly did at that time, and I didn't disagree with any of it because when I watched that character and I watched his programs that you knew he was very hands-on with, I always thought he enhanced his stories a lot. And that was a guy that I think is one of the better people when it comes to crafting stories and putting together matches. I think he is a guy that I'm never a big fan of talent doubling over as creative, and he was never officially on the creative team, but he would be one of those guys I think you would lean on. So I really didn't have any issue because I thought a lot of the stuff he was attached to was greatly helped by him.
Yeah, he seems like a guy with just a great smart mind for the business, in particular on the heel side. I mean, I think you see it in, you know, a guy like a Kevin Owens, many of the qualities that Bubba Ray also exhibits. Just kind of the command of the crowd and how he's able to just psychologically manipulate a lot of the situations that he's in. I think he probably has a long career even after his in-ring is done.
And if you go back to the Dixie Carter, that build up to the table spot, you could certainly question, if you are on TNA's side, the fact that they knew his deal was coming due and he was positioned as the biggest babyface In that company, and so much was built around him, and he got that massive spot with Dixie Carter, that if you did not have an assurance that this guy was returning, why build so much around him? You could certainly question that, but TNA was guilty of that with a lot of people that they knew.
AJ,
yeah. Hogan. I mean, a lot of these guys, you knew their deals were coming due, and they left on such high notes. I mean, that hurt them after a while. All right, so that wraps up our review of Straight Outta Dudleyville with an unknown area code within that city. But next week, Way, we are going to do something wacky. We are going to live dangerously because we are going back 17 years to March of 1999, and we are going to review Living Dangerously to segue off of this ECW heavy influence of this week's show, to review an ECW pay-per-view from March of 1999. It is Living Dangerously, featuring the Dudleys at this particular time period. And this is available on the WWE Network.
Wow.
So you can all check it out.
How much is that?
I guess it depends where you live.
Oh, okay.
It could be 9.99 yen. It could be... How much is it here in Canada? $11.99?
I
think it's $11.99.
11? Okay.
Maybe more. Maybe less.
You're still getting a deal.
Lots of different price points out there.
Yeah. So, yeah, whatever. Go watch it however you'd like.
Is this going to force you to live dangerously over the next week? People are concerned.
No. I will be living very safely.
Okay, living safely, which was the second idea for this pay-per-view name.
I'm actually looking forward to this. We also had Tommy Dreamer in the studio a week ago at the Fight Network. So,
why don't you quickly tell us about, because I did my interview with him, and then you and our pal George Barbosa.
We did a two-hour interview with Tommy Dreamer for an upcoming series that we're producing for the Fight Network called Retrospective, where we basically get whoever... we can get access to and who's willing to do these extended interviews, whether it be a UFC fighter or a professional wrestler. We've done one with Santino Marella. I believe Eric Young recently did one with us. And now, most recently, Tommy Dreamer, where we sit them in a very more of an intimate environment and just kind of get them to tell us their stories of their entire careers. And so sitting down and, you know, hearing Tommy Dreamer talk about his extended discussion about his ECW run, it kind of made me a little bit nostalgic for to check out some ECW. So I'm definitely looking forward to this review.
Okay, so among the matches here, we are going to get Sabu against Taz for both the ECW and the prestigious Fuck the World title. Shane Douglas and Tommy Dreamer against the Impact Players, and in a tag team match way, the Dudley Boys, Bubba and Devon, against Spike Dudley and his partner, Sid.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Sid and ECW.
Sid's illustrious ECW run back here in 1999. So that is coming up on next week's edition of the show, so we will chat about that from Asbury Park, New Jersey. Living Dangerously, 1999. So we will chat with you then. Thank you for listening to Review Away. Subscribe to Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes and subscribe to our YouTube channel, youtube.com/liveaudiowrestling. Go give the lip sync contest a watch. See how the people performed and find out the mystery winner.
Yeah, some controversy about whether or not we chose the right guy to win.
I've
heard more split decisions.
Yes, Dan Lavransky disagreed with our pick.
Oh, a lot of people did.
Yes. So, you know what? Never leave it in the hands of the judges.
That's right.
That's what they tell you. And we are going to end off this show by going back to an interview that I conducted with Bubba Ray Dudley. This was over WrestleMania weekend in 2015 in California. This was after Bubba's Royal Rumble appearance earlier that year, but before the Dudley's return in Brooklyn. So here it is to end off this week's Review Away, myself with Bubba Ray Dudley.
This is my first time away in 20 years. I mean, since I started back, I mean, you know, since I got my first break in ECW in 95, I've been, you know, under contract with a company and been constantly on the road. I haven't taken any time off. I've been relatively injury free. So this is the first time that I decided to step back on my own, and me and Devon kind of looked at each other and said, let's just take a break from, you know, from doing everything, since there's really nothing left for us to do. I mean, we've kind of conquered the world of tag team wrestling, so what we're really doing is concentrating on our wrestling school. The Team 3D Academy in Kissimmee, Florida, I mean, we've been open since 2007. We're very proud of the fact that we've had students from over 30 countries, and we're a real deal wrestling school. So that's what we're really concentrating on. A lot of people asking us, you know, are we ever going to see you here? Where are we going to see you there? Maybe. It depends if it's the right fit for us. If it's the right fit for us, then you might see us again.
Tell us a bit about Chris Melendez, because the world has gotten to see him since coming on to Impact Wrestling. An incredible story. Just take us back to, you know, your first interactions with Chris Melendez, and looking objectively at someone pursuing a career in this industry, if you believe that this would be viable for him.
Long story short with Chris, Chris meets Ken Anderson. Ken was working with the Wounded Warrior Project, and Chris says, hey, can you train me to wrestle? And Ken says, well, I don't have a school, but I'll take you to two guys that I know, you know, do you, you know, train you the right way. And Ken told me about, you know, Chris. And I told Chris, meet me at in New York at one of the TNA shows that we did. And I sat down with him, and I listened to him, and he said, I had two dreams in life. I wanted to serve on the front line for my country, and I wanted to be a pro wrestler. And the guy seemed really, really serious. And I said, listen, you relocate to Florida on your own dime, and I'll train you for free just because of what you did for our country. And a month later, he was there. Spent about 2 years at the school, signed his first contract with TNA, and he's doing really well, you know, and he's a, you know, a huge success story. You know, here's a guy that, you know, was on a tour of Afghanistan, had about, you know, 2 weeks left there, steps on a mine, has his frickin' leg blown off, and, you know, didn't let it stop him. So, you know, you got to give Chris a lot of credit for, you know, continuing to follow his dreams.
Do you still have, you know, having to kind of separate a lot of dreamers that maybe show up at the school, ones who don't fully understand what this business entails and what you are there to teach them? Is it still a divide of kind of seeking out those people and those people being weeded out?
I get a lot of, you know, students that come into the school who, you know, they're like, I'll ask them, what makes you think that you can become a successful pro wrestler? And they say, well, I watch every week and I really, really want to do this. That's not going to make you a successful pro wrestler. To me, you have to have a passion for this industry. You want this to be your life. It's like if you ask a little kid, what do you want to do with your, you know, with your life? I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. Well, when I was a little kid, I always knew I want to be a pro wrestler. So I want people who are very serious about making pro wrestling their life, and who are going to put their family first and pro wrestling second, and that's about it. Give up your life for the business, and this business will treat you really well.
As you have that time now to kind of sit back and you look at all that you have done, and it's really interesting as you look back at your career and how it's very distinct chapters where different versions of yourself, unlike the one that preceded it. Do you look at Bully Ray and that character and where it got to is kind of a really crowning achievement for you, and just what that became in TNA, completely reinventing yourself yet again?
And the funny thing about Bully Ray is it was never a goal of mine. When I was a little kid, my first memories of pro wrestling or Fuji and Saito or Jules and Jay Strongbow or Gurria and Martel, you know, the Moondogs, the Samoans, I grew up loving and idolizing tag team wrestling because I always looked at it as, wow, if two guys can be entertaining in the ring, four guys can be doubly as entertaining. And I love tag team wrestling. And growing up, I always said to myself, wow, I would love to be involved in a tag team. I'd love to be involved in a tag team. And then when I had the opportunity in ECW and me and Devon got together, you know, I knew that we had that chemistry and I knew that we had something special, you know. And Team 3D, the Dudleys back in the day, were kind of looked at as a joke, you know. The whole Dudley family was, you know, it wasn't taken real seriously, but I knew that me and Devon had something special. And we went on to become the most successful tag team of all time. I'll never sit back here and tell you that we're the greatest tag team of all time, because I don't know what constitutes greatness in pro wrestling. What makes one guy greater than the other, or one team greater than the other? I mean, it's subjective.
Completely.
Yeah, so are me and Devon the greatest tag team of all time? No, I'm just happy that people even, you know, say that we are, or even mention us in the top 10. What I can tell you for sure is we're the most successful team of all time, and we've had the most longevity out of all the tag teams. So one day we kind of just sat back and we're like, you know, getting back to your original question, like, what is there left to do as a team? There's nothing. So that's when me and Devon went our separate ways, and that's when I invented Bully Ray. But Bully Ray is really just Bubba Ray Dudley from ECW. You know, I wasn't going to reinvent the wheel. I'm just the biggest, baddest, loudest motherfucker that's going to be in that ring who can back himself up physically and verbally. I'll stand toe-to-toe with anybody in that ring, in that microphone. I don't think there's a person, you know, in the ring that I can't hang with, you know, on that microphone. So,
as you look, and you bring up the verbal aspect of this industry, and I think that's something that there's a certain generation that you're a part of that it was just, it comes from the heart. You believe what you are saying, and I think that that's such a valuable tool that so many people, such as your students and coming up through the ranks that you'll see here at conventions like this, that maybe have not quite grasped that aspect of the industry where you feel that character. And is that something you look at as something I do want to continue with, and I do want to teach these students what I learned at a part in the industry where you're not necessarily seeing that growth on the verbal end of things for some?
Being able to speak in this business is probably more important than anything else. Having a character that people can relate to, whether they want to love you, whether they want to hate you, whether they want to laugh with you, cry with you. You have to tap into people's emotions, and you have to make them want to see you do something. They have to want to see you win. They want to have to see you lose. To me, moves really don't mean anything. You got to have a skill set of moves. You have to know how to be a decent wrestler in the ring. But at the end of the day, some of the most successful guys in the history of our industry were not great wrestlers, but they were incredible talkers and great entertainers. And that's what I feel that I had morphed into as Bully Ray. I had some really, really quality matches, but I think my strengths lied in how I spoke, the promos I cut, and the passion in which I speak.
And we'll just finish up here because I know a lot of listeners, a lot of viewers are curious just to get into your mindset about, you know, the decision to step away from TNA. Was that something that was not an easy decision to come to, something that was months in the making, and what ultimately did lead you to that decision?
It was a very easy decision. There was nothing left for me to do. And when you sit back and you go to, you know, okay, so I was part of an extremely successful tag team in TNA, Team 3D. We got inducted into the Hall of Fame in TNA. I broke away, and as Bully Ray became what many people say was the most over heel in the entire wrestling business for a certain time, you know, became a 2-time TNA World Heavyweight Champion, got to work with guys like Sting. And have some, you know, phenomenal matches with him and AJ Styles, and be a part of the Aces and Eights, and, you know, married to Brooke and fighting with Hulk, and so many great things happen. And then after that, you know, putting Dixie Carter through a table, and then the whole tag team series with the Hardys and the Wolves. That's a lot.
Sure.
That's a lot of stuff. And after I sat back and I look, I go, well, how can I top all this? What can I really do that's going to be even more special? What can I do that the people are going to really want to see more than this? And I didn't see anything, so that's why I stepped away. I never want to become stale. I always want to keep moving forward. I always want to continue to entertain the fans. I look at pro wrestling and me and my act, or me and Devon's act, I look at it as the rock and roll band Kiss or Motley Crue. How are we going to top ourselves next? Because I just don't want to go out there and continue to play the same songs and do the same pyro and spit the same blood and the same crap. I want to play the greatest hits. But I want to do it in a different way. So the next time you see Team 3D or Bully Ray, you're going to see them in the way you know and love, but with the next edge, the next spin on us.
Well, we appreciate it very much. And for those out there, where can they get information on the school? If someone out there maybe is watching this and they are an aspiring wrestler.
If you are an aspiring wrestler and you are serious about pro wrestling, you can go to team3dacademy.com. You can find us on Facebook at Team 3D Academy. We're on Instagram at Team 3D Academy. Just look up Team 3D Academy and you're gonna find us. And like I said, proud to have trained students from over 30 countries, and have many students have gone into either WWE Developmental or TNA or Ring of Honor or Japan, and just real happy that we have a quality wrestling school.